Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, the President's Weekly Address. Now, the President of the United States.
I've just returned from Oslo, Norway, where it was my privilege to accept the Nobel Peace Prize, an award I did not, in all honesty, deserve. And some in this country have asked, why did I choose to accept it? In truth, I could have taken the path of one of my heroes, Marlon Brando, and refused to accept the prize. And it might have ended up going to someone more deserving. But if the President of the United States rejects the honor, doesn't that in itself have the effect of reducing the prestige, the importance of the Nobel Peace Prize? If it's only going to be given to anonymous folks toiling in the most forgotten corners of the globe, doesn't that marginalize this award, which instead should command the keen attention of the world? It seemed to me that rejecting the honor would have dishonored it. It might be the easy path to enjoy the momentary exhilaration of moral purity and diverting the plaudits and the money to someone more deserving. But unlike them, I live in the world as it is. A world where peace can often be brought only by war. A world where war is most often threatened by peace. In the months of deliberation since this prize was announced, I had to ask myself this question. If Neville Chamberlain had been given this award, would his rejection of it have defeated Hitler's armies? There is evil in this world. If I had refused the honor, what if the next recipient chosen had been secretly smuggling nuclear materials to the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, and we had only become aware of that fact during a terrifying acceptance speech? We're all learning that sometimes the path to peace leads through war. In the same way, the path to rejection sometimes leads through acceptance. So today, I give you, my fellow citizens, and the folks at the Nobel Institute, this solemn pledge. If by our firm deadline in 2011, our troops in Afghanistan had not either begun to withdraw or been given a new mission to allow them to do so at a later date, I will give back this prize. In the meantime, if anyone from the nominating committee is listening, I would be interested in my name being put forward for the Nobel Prize for Physics next year. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I don't know much about fundamental particles. But every once in a while, I do like to get physical. Thanks, and have a great weekend.
Funds for the support of this broadcast came from the Fund for Support of This Broadcast. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Dressed in leather, and the angels are in chains. The sugar plums are rancid, and the stockings are in flames. There's a demon in my belly, and a gremlin in my brain. There's someone up the chimney, holding Satan is his name. And it's Christmas with the devil. Christmas with the devil. And the reindeer ran away. There'll be no Father Christmas, 'cause it's evil's holiday. So come on, ye unfaithful, don't be left out in the cold. You don't need no invitation, your ticket is your soul. I know that it's a Christmas with the devil. No, 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 that it is a Christmas with the devil. angels in hell. No snow below. Dressed in leather, and the angels are in chains. The sugar plums are rancid, and the stockings are in flames. So come on, ye unfaithful, don't be left out in the cold. You don't need no invitation, your ticket is your soul. Because it's Christmas with the devil. Don't you know that it is Christmas with the devil.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this very, very, they're all special, as you know, but the very special edition of the show. By the way, entering our, 27th year on the air? Good Lord. That is frightening. Get me my cane, please, someone. Hello. Anyway, that was that musical selection there was just a taste, just a taster of what's in store for the fun-loving crowds in New York City this Tuesday night at Joe's Pub, and in New Orleans at the Contemporary Arts Center this Friday and Saturday at the final iterations this year of the Shearer Owen Christmas Show for the benefit of the New Orleans Musicians Clinic. You miss it, you miss a lot. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, news of the digital wonderland. This pretty much supports something we've already heard documented in this country, which is most people here, in response to a survey, reveal that they didn't really, once they bought their big new big screens, didn't really mess around with connecting it up so they could get HD, you see, because that's so important, the HD thing. Because it's such. So here we go from the BBC. An HD TV is not the only piece of equipment you need. A staggering majority. Well, we drink a lot this time of year. A staggering majority of UK consumers are not getting the best out of their HD televisions, according to a survey. 56% of UK households now have one. 91% still watch standard DVDs and get their television through standard set-top boxes. I guess the difference isn't that dramatic. I guess it's not like color. Oh, yeah, I got the new color set, but I'm not watching any color. What? Full HD broadcasting. For films, must be played on a Blu-ray, you see. But maybe not. A survey of 2,000 adults showed 81% admitted to not getting the best. They admitted it. From any of their high-tech gadgets in their homes. Many consumers who have all the technology in hand to view full HD may not be setting up the devices and cables properly to do so. Sometimes it's as simple as not using the correct cable. Implications are that people are stymied by the technical details. 27% of respondents admitted to not reading the instruction manuals. Only 27% admitted to it. And 29% gave up at the outset, saying modern technology is too complicated. So it was a good idea to spend all the money, you know, making that transition, because people don't really care, you see. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're looking for impermeable walls, To whom do you call? Yes, whom? Thank you. Egypt has begun constructing a huge metal wall along its border with the Gaza Strip as it attempts to cut off smuggling tunnels. When it's finished, the wall will be 6 to 7 miles long and extend 18 meters below the surface. The plan has been shrouded in secrecy with no comment or confirmation from the Egyptian government. It'll take 18 months to complete. The barrier, made of super-strength steel, has been hidden deep underground. The BBC has been told it fits together in similar fashion to a jigsaw, that it has been tested to ensure it is bomb-proof. The reports say the wall cannot be cut or melted. In short, it is impenetrable. 4 kilometers of the wall has already been completed, with work now beginning in the south. Israelis say the tunnels are used to smuggle people, weapons, and the components of rockets. The BBC says Palestinians smuggle the everyday items they are denied by the blockade. Who's building the wall? Who's designing and building the wall? An impenetrable wall, ladies and gentlemen. The United States Army Corps of Engineers. So, you know, it'll be penetrable. 18 months? They can't get a meeting together in 18 months in this country. But you see, it's the secrecy that makes for the speed and the thing. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is, almost the middle of December. Well-nigh time to start looking back in rancor at the events of the past year, as depicted on this particular broadcast. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for our annual feature. And it begins with the beginning of the era of hope and change. So welcome to
The Year in Rebuke. When Barack Obama announced his candidacy for president, he did so in the same place where Abraham Lincoln announced his candidacy. When Barack Obama was writing his inaugural address, he read the speeches of Abraham Lincoln. When Barack Obama took the oath of office to become the 44th president of the United States, his hand was on Abraham Lincoln's Bible. Surely, our new president has no more important role model than Abraham Lincoln. Now, from the Mintland Mint, the first Obama collectible that's more than just another Obama collectible, the Barack Obama What Would Lincoln Do Talking Calendar. Every day brings a new reminder of what Abraham Lincoln was doing on that very day.
Today in 1862, President Lincoln met with his Secretary of War.
Today in 1861, President Lincoln had dinner with leading senators.
Imagine each day brings a new dose of inspiration from the man who inspires our new president. The What Would Lincoln Do talking calendar has a digital readout so you can clearly see the day and date, and a hefty 3-inch speaker so you can hear each day's Lincoln moment from virtually across the room. But wait, there's more, much more. The What Would Lincoln Do talking calendar is completely searchable. It's the first interactive talking calendar ever made available as part of a presidential inauguration promotion. As far as we know, whenever you want to know what would Lincoln do, just press the talk button and ask,
what would Lincoln have for lunch?
Two of Lincoln's favorite foods were fruit salad and sorghum cake.
Should I go straight to college or, like, take a year off?
Lincoln never went to college, and he studied law at home.
Cool. Thanks, talking calendar.
If the What Would Lincoln Do calendar was sold in stores, you'd pay $60 to $70 for this amazing high-quality appliance. But there aren't any stores, so you can only order this souvenir that's so much more than a souvenir through this special TV offer, or online, or out of a booth at selected farmers markets. Imagine, just like President Obama, when you're faced with a big decision, you can ask,
what would Lincoln do?
What would Lincoln do?
Yo, what would, Lincoln do?
But this special TV offer can't last forever. Soon, this remarkably accurate talking calendar will be sold in stores.
Lincoln turned to new gadgets to help win the war.
You could be like Senator Barack Obama and spend hundreds of hours and hundreds of dollars buying books and doing other kinds of Lincoln research. Or you can be like President Obama and save money to help our economy. Plus, if you order the amazing What Would Lincoln Do talking calendar within the next 10 minutes, It may even go out in today's shipping.
Lincoln wrote, "This habit of uselessly wasting time is the whole difficulty."
So act now. Dial 1-844-ABE-TALKS. Have your credit card ready. Our New Delhi representatives are notoriously impatient. That's 1-844-ABE-TALKS. For faster service, dial quicker or order online. To find out our web address, call 1-844-ABE-TALKS.
Lincoln said, "Things may come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle."
Call now. My friends on the radio program today, I said I hoped President Obama fails. We didn't have time on the broadcast. As you know, I only have 3 hours, and the breadth and depth of the Limbaugh worldview far exceeds that paltry ration of minutes. We didn't have time for me to complete my list of hopes as we enter this era of hope. So now, here, exclusive to online subscribers to the Platinum Rush Bucket, here goes. I hope Michelle Obama trips on the hem of the next long gown she puts on and falls into the arms of Senator David Vitter. I hope Sasha and Malia flunk out of Sidwell Friends. I hope Joe Biden's hair plugs start falling out from stress. I hope Barney Frank takes the wrong companion to the next gay pride parade and wakes up the following morning on the Boston docks, dazed and bleeding. I hope Tim Geithner gets confirmed as Secretary of the Treasury just before we learn that he's also been head of an identity theft ring and he hasn't reported the income on that either. I hope Sasha and Malia flunk out of Washington, D.C. public school. I hope that Obama's mother-in-law snores loudly. Hell, I hope she sleepwalks and snores. I hope Rahm Emanuel has one of his famous swearing episodes, loses complete control, and calls Sasha and Malia a couple of baby hoes. I hope that President Obama is playing basketball in the White House gym when the next terrorist attack occurs, not if, my friends, when, and that at that exact moment he sinks a three-point shot. I hope that Howard Dean goes back to practicing medicine and loses his first patient on the operating table. I hope Harry Reid goes back to drinking. I hope Nancy Pelosi takes up drinking. And finally, my friends, I hope that Al Franken succeeds in weaseling his way into the United States Senate after all, which will drive that body's approval rating even lower, below his old radio ratings, if such a thing is mathematically possible. And, my friends, I hope that on his first visit to the White House, he gets a little too toked up and puts a move on Sasha and Malia. That, from the Limbaugh Institute of Platinum Online Content, is what I hope for the Democrats. Find out what I hope for the Republicans. Click the box to sign up for Titanium Content.
this food but not. I'm not too big on talking if my mind ain't worked it out. Better to let people think you're dumb than to speak and remove all doubt. And I've no plans to be wearing out your welcome mat. You know I never wanna make you sorry. Not too big on that. Not too big on, too big on that.
We'll continue our year in rebuke moments from now, but first, news from outside the bubble. This very morning on a discussion program about religion, here's former Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, being asked kind of a cute question.
If you had known then that there were no WMDs, would you still have gone on?
I would still have thought it right to remove them. I mean, obviously, you would have had to use and deploy different arguments about the nature of the threat. I can't really think we'd be better with him, his two sons still in charge, but it's incredibly difficult, and I totally understand. That's why, I sympathise with the people who were against it for perfectly good reasons and are against it now.
And I sympathise with you, Tony, for the need to come up with those different arguments about the threat. Key parts of Tony Blair's evidence to the British inquiry into the Iraq War, the Chilcot inquiry, will be held in secret, sources close to the hearings now reveal. His conversations with President Bush when he was Prime Minister and crucial details of the decision-making process that led Britain into war will fall under the scope of national security and the protection of Britain's relations with the U.S. There are also suggestions by well-placed sources that anything, quote, interesting, unquote, will also be shrouded in secrecy, leaving his public appearance next month containing little more than is already known. He's already said more than that on a TV interview about religion. More about the British inquiry into the Iraq War. Tony Blair was urged by a senior British officer 2 days before the invasion to delay the military offensive because preparations for dealing with the aftermath were not ready. Concern about the legality of the invasion, its cost, and a complete lack of focus in the government prevented the Blair government from preparing adequately for the consequences in Iraq, the inquiry heard from Major General Tim Cross, the UK military official appointed to help plan the invasion aftermath. He said there were serious concerns of legality and money. The British government was reluctant to sign up to the U.S. body responsible for post-war planning for fear of being, quote, liable under international law, he added. What's that? International law. I have to look that up. He described the preparations as woefully thin. Although I was confident we would secure a military victory, I offered my view we should not begin that campaign until we had a much more coherent post-war plan. Tony Blair, he said, nodded and didn't say anything particular. I hesitate to say I used the word disaster, Cross added. I may well have used the word chaotic. But more, the ex-spy chief of Britain, Sir John Scarlett, told the Iraq War Inquiry there was no conscious intention to manipulate information about Iraq's weapons. He said it would have been better to have made it clear in the September 2002 dossier upon which the British government relied in whipping up public support for the war. It would have been better to have made it clear that the claim that Iraq could use WMD within 45 minutes of an order from Saddam, better to have made it clear that referred to battlefield munitions and not missiles. Since the thought about missiles is what scared people. He was not asked at the hearing about a member of parliament's claim that a taxi driver was the source of the 45-minute information. Conservative member of parliament Adam Holloway published a report this week saying advice casting doubt on the 45-minute claim was ignored. He was the source of the taxi driver thing. Sir John Scarlett, the former head of intelligence, also told the inquiry that on March 19th, the day before the invasion, the Joint Intelligence Committee discussed intelligence suggesting Iraq had disassembled its chemical weapons capability and might find it difficult to reconstitute it. He said this was not new information, and the Prime Minister and other ministers were informed of its conclusion. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, once more,
the year in rebuke.
Hello, from CPR, Continental Public Radio in Washington, I'm Cody Outscoop, and this is What Up Dog. What Up Dog? CPR's new news blogazine for the young and the newsless. Thanks for multitasking us into your day. I'm Cody Outscoop. You may have heard on our companion newscast for older listeners about the auction this week in New York of some of the effects of the founder of India, Mahatma Gandhi. We sure did. It sent us in search of a reporter who could give us the 411 on an even more unusual auction, and it turned out to be CPR's own special correspondent, Aviva Schlarman.
Word, Cody.
Said Aviva. So, dude, what could be more unusual than a Mahatma Gandhi auction?
He called me dude. Cody, at New York's Knickerbocker Galleries this week, we saw the auctioning off of the property of an icon of 20th century charity, Mother Teresa.
Oh, no, pump the brakes there, sister. Wasn't she like the poorest woman on the planet?
Well, she served the poor, and to be honest, nobody would confuse her with, oh, who's a rich woman that the kids know, Oprah? But, of course, like anyone living in even the periphery of Western civilization, there were objects in Mother Teresa's life that might turn out to be valuable to somebody. Knickerbocker Galleries owner Freddie Vanderbilt thought long and hard about the possibilities.
I mean, if she isn't an icon, you know, like, who is, you know, really? And we kind of specialize in the auctioning of important properties of contemporary icons. I mean, we just finished doing a very unique event. We conducted an auction of several hundred originals of Michael Jackson's legal bills. And in several cases, the bills went for more than the amount they were billing for.
That must have been a first.
Well, that's what our press release said. So when Mr. Gustav Feldschreiber approached us with this extremely unique collection, we got very excited. Of course, we're always very excited. That's just sort of how we roll. But I mean, really excited.
So, Freddie, what actually was in this collection? What sort of possessions did Mother Teresa
possess? Well, there was a most unique lot that consisted of number 2 pencils on chains. Must have been 500 of them in all.
Pencils on chains.
Mm-hmm. From the documentation Mr. Feldschreiber provided, apparently she used to let the poor people she was feeding use the pencils to write down messages or Bible verses or whatever, but she didn't want them stealing the pencils.
Because she wanted other poor people to be able to use them?
I don't know. Maybe it's hard to get pencils in India. They may have gone straight to ballpoint technology or something.
Well, what else were people bidding on?
Oh, furious bidding. I mean, really intensely unique over lot 223, which was a half dozen head shawls.
This must have been The black shawls we saw her wearing in every news photo.
Well, apparently so. All the documentation indicated was that they were manufactured in Thailand, and because of the non-industrial process used to make them, their color ranged from grayish black to almost a bluish black. Very striking. The lot sold for $4,500, which, I'm telling you, in this economy, is quite remarkable.
And, Cody, mm-hmm. this auction had quite a few celebrity bidders in attendance.
Drop some bold-faced names on us, Aviva.
Well, fashion icon Tim Gunn was there.
Oh, she was an icon. She could be disturbing, perplexing. Her look was austere. No ruching, nothing gathered, absolutely nothing cut on the bias. And yet, there was something almost drastically chic about mm-hmm. her. She made it work. I loved her.
And what did you buy?
Oh, nothing. I was just a looky-loo.
Aviva, this Gustav Feldschreiber who put these things up mm-hmm. for auction, what do we know about him?
Well, here's what Freddie Vandervelde had to say about him.
He's a fiduciary agent of the Russian mafia who, before their fortunes were decimated by the recent drop in the price of oil, began building collections of various kinds of valuables for resale on the international market, with himself receiving 20% off the top and depositing the proceeds in a portfolio of offshore shell banking entities. That's really all I know. Needless to say, he's quite a unique fellow. Apparently, he came into possession of these objects in Mumbai after Mother Teresa's former apartment was being prepared for condo conversion.
Freddie, what's your favorite object from this collection? If you could have bid, what would you have bid on?
Oh, honestly, I think that the Timex watch, if it just was a very important piece. We reset its time zone for the auction. It was still on Mumbai time when we opened the consignment, and it kept perfect time throughout the evening. And the leather band just couldn't have been more distressed.
A very undistressed auctioneer who, by the end of the evening, had gaveled $1,500,000 into those offshore banking entities, Cody.
That would buy a lot of pencils on chains, Aviva.
It sure would.
Aviva Schlorman, killer report on the Mother Teresa auction. Big props.
Thank you.
Tomorrow's just a few mouse clicks away, and that's when we're back with another posting of What Up Dog. Our thanks to the whole CPR News posse and to the John and Melinda Fry Foundation. Fry is fly. Till the next one, I'm Cody Outscoop. Peace out. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And this is Le Show with the year in rebuke. It doesn't take much jostling of the old memory to recall that this will go down as the year of fairly massive disruption of the economic activities of this country. And some of them have been chronicled musically in songs that were heard on this show and are now available for sale. What am I talking about? For sale at iTunes. But probably the poster child for misbehavior during all of this, private misbehavior, let's leave the government out of it for the moment, was the huge insurance conglomerate cobbled together in the 90s when so many of the conglomerates soon to fail were cobbled together. It was good cobbling in the 90s. AIG. And AIG, of course, was near to the point at the brink of bankruptcy or at the bank of bankruptcy, and was rescued, and so were its what they call in the business counterparties, including Goldman Sachs. And then there came the next question. Well, how do you once you've rescued AIG, how does it stay in business with the bad name that it's acquired? Question Tiger Woods might be wondering right about now. And so, probably a meeting, a teleconference or two were held.
Well, something we're going to have to do.
Folks, we've got the teleconference line for only an hour. Mr. Liddy's due, as I understand it, for a deposition or a deposit or something. So let's get cracking, if we may. Okay, we've got some AIG people here. We've got Mr. Liddy on the teleconference. We've got our people from Idea Farm.
I'm Jordan Delmarva, chief innovationist at Idea Farm. Mr. Liddy, can you see and hear me okay?
Yes, yes. You look a little green, but otherwise...
Well, our whole company is going green. Funny, but true. But okay, problem. World's biggest insurance company now has a TNP, toxic news profile. Bob Waldorp of AIG approached us on the problem 2 weeks ago. Bob, you want to dribble this one in for Deuce?
Thanks, Jordan. Good assist. Folks, the federal government owns 80% of this company. They're going to want to get some money back out of the investment later rather than sooner, true, but still in a lifetime time frame. We've got to sell off our profitable businesses to generate some of that revenue for eventual repurposing by the government. But all those businesses have the naming AIG as their framing. Now, that's a drag on the value of those enterprises. It's like a hedge fund manager goes home at night and says, honey, you made a great deal today. I bought 2 million shares of Hitler insurance. I mean, seriously. So I'm not an idea guy. I'm not a computer risk modeling guy. I'm not a tax implications guy. I'm a what do we do now guy. So I went to the number one idea guy in a business he invented, the idea guy business, and Jordan's marching orders were simple. Create a new identity for AIG, a winning, competent, likable identity. Yes, Ed?
We prioritized likable, right? Because the other two were heavy lifting.
That is correct. And Jordan, you got what for us?
We gave ourselves permission to be really creative. We didn't just go all over the map. We drew a new map. We test drove more than 100 different strategies. We focus grouped 15 of those. The top three are what we've brought today, and the top two of those will go out for more testing, which will end up putting them in hierarchical ranking.
So you've got the numerical side of this pretty covered.
Word. Laurel was the concept manager on our first finalist.
Hi, everybody. I'm Laurel Bay. We went for a holistic approach. We threw out everything that we knew about AIG right out the window. The good, the bad, the ugly, the whatever. And we asked ourselves one question. What's the most likable animal today? Eh?
Likable animal? What do you mean, besides a puppy?
They don't stay puppies forever. See, this isn't that easy. We did a level 3 Google excavation of likable references to animals. The result was off the charts. Nobody, men, women, you name it, nobody likes anything as much as a penguin by a factor of 3. So, meet Pete. Likes...
Insurance is cool. Penguin insurance is cooler.
Excuse me, we don't insure penguins.
Likes, the concept is very simply penguin. The naming appears on our products, our buildings, our everything. We've even got PNGN for a new stock exchange symbol.
Excuse me, is that supposed to make people feel that we're a safe investment? In fact, we're named after an endangered bird?
In fairness, some subspecies are doing very well indeed right now in certain habitat segments.
You know, I didn't want to squash this, but because I think the execution was way strong, very, very believable, very adorable. But I think I see Ed's trajectory on this. Also, AIG Legal got early word that the Linux people would go lawsuit on us. They've been using a penguin mark for 20 years. So let's move it on over to my man Solomon over here.
Thanks. In my unit, we like to think that what we do is problem solving. Problem, 3 letters. Overcomplicated solution, change the name. The right solution, change people's perception of those 3 letters. Ed, how would you pronounce the name of your company?
AIG. What is a Sesame freaking Street?
And how would you pronounce those 3 letters?
Well, I guess egg. But...
And after we've spent $175 million in a campaign so viral it would literally make your head spin, you join the 210 million Americans who pronounce it egg. As in, you feel safer inside the egg. Money you save in not having to redesign and rebrand your visuals goes straight to viral. We've got some great banner mock-ups here to show you. This would go on top of the Drudge Report front page. Can you read it, Ed? The 2 successive images. Mm-hmm. The first is the AIG lettering in a beautifully rendered actual egg. Flash wipe to the second panel just says, hasn't broken yet.
Mm-hmm. Until some internet smartass hacked it to read hopelessly scrambled.
You know, a tagline that tested completely off the meter was, it all begins with egg.
Not the egg?
No, sir. That particular verbiage made a certain percentage of our focus groups think immediately of either the chicken or the sperm, depending on demographics.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in here, Solomon, and take it to the next level personally. Ed, I know that you've had your head buried in all the numbers stuff, but a very cool movement in modern branding is the female persona, giving a company, a service, medication, a name that suggests it's feminine, that it has goddess-type characteristics while retaining all its masculine strength. You think of Boniva, you think of Humana, you think of Cialis, for God's sake. So, introducing Insura. Lights.
Insura, protecting the future. The future of protection.
Now, Michelle Pfeiffer has expressed interest in being the voice of Futura and joining our team. Lights, here are some things our test shoppers told us about Insura. Clean, strong, motherly, peace of mind, warm. Here's some things they told us about AIG. Thieves, monsters, traitors, piano wire. I don't know. Seems like a concession slam dunk to me.
Okay. That's what you've got.
That's what we've got. Three very contemporary, very strong visions. Penguin, egg, and Insura, three very strong executions, pardon the expression. IdeaFarm is ready to focus like a laser beam whenever you want to go. Of course, impressions are right now being formed by uncontrolled media, so sooner we green button this.
We're going to have a 5 p.m. video conference of my people on this, Jordan.
Really?
Yeah. Why not? Government's paying for it. Bob, you blast facts to the regional people on this,
Jordan. Yes, sir.
We should have something for you by mid-morning tomorrow.
Okay, sir. I thank you. I wish you a good deposition.
Don't you hear that alarm clock? Get on out of that bed and wash your simple head. Can't you hear that alarm clock? I say, get out of that bed and get prepared to go to work. If I only buy some ham and eggs. I haven't had a square meal for many, many days. I can hear my stomach growling, and there's nothing I can do. Pray to the Lord, dear people, that it will never happen to you. Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs. Can't you hear me calling you? Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs.
Can't you hear me calling you? If I only could find a dollar, I'd buy some ham and eggs. Just as soon as settled for big fat chicken legs. They say there's no depression and there's a lot of work to do. Pray to the Lord, dear people, it will never happen to you. Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs.
Ham and eggs. Can't you hear? Can't you hear me calling?
We're back at Neverland, or more accurately, in the vicinity of Neverland. The Good Morning America has an exclusive today, and we wish them all the best. I'm going back to Los Angeles tonight to host the third annual Shoulder Pad Foundation's Run for a Hunch kickoff dinner. But right now, I'm joined by an old friend of this program who's joining us in our re-remembering of Michael Jackson. He's the former lead singer of Boys Are Us, and I'm going to stop introducing him that way just as soon as his solo career really takes off. Dewey Gordon. Dewey, it's beautiful here, isn't it?
Yes, sir, Mr. King. No sign of the turmoil or the lawsuits or the children and their parents or anything. Just the scenery and the security fence.
Yeah, I should say we're right outside the Neverland property line. Our thanks to the security people for not re-electrifying the fence until after we finished taping. Dewey.
Yes.
Did you ever work with Michael Jackson?
No, I didn't, Mr. King. Boys R Us was just taking off as his career was going into a little bit of a tailing off, I guess you might say. And our manager at the time, the great Mr. Nate Pendleton, he thought it was bad luck, I guess, in a way, for us to be anywhere near Michael. He thought it might impede our freshness, is the way he put it.
You were mighty fresh. So as the years went on, did you ever meet Michael?
Well, of course, by the time Boys R Us broke up, the dew was off my particular rose, in a sense, so I never got an invite or anything like that. I was at a Diana Ross concert at Staples Center, where we heard that Michael was in one of the luxury boxes, so I guess you could say we kind of shared that experience together. And I do have to say, Mr. King, should anything happen to Michael's mother, what a wonderful mother Miss Ross would be to those children. And you know, Michael knew that.
Yeah, he did. He knew so much. Mm-hmm. So, Dewey, I'm just looking through my cards here. What is your association or connection with Michael Jackson?
Good question, Mr. King.
Thanks.
Well, as you know, I'm not too good with words. I express myself mainly in my music, and I was just so devastated by the suddenness and the unexpectedness and the surpriseness of Michael's passing. And I was driving around Beverly Hills with my manager, the great Jack Fontaine, and we started talking about our memories of Michael, and the next thing you know, Jack was on the phone with the great producer, Monkey C, and by nightfall, I was in Monkey C's studio working on my tribute song to Michael, and I brought a mix of that song with me here today.
So you want us to play it?
Well, you've always been so good to me, Mr. King, and so, yeah.
Okay, what's it called?
It's called He Was the King, because after all, for so many of us, that's what he was.
Yeah, good reason. And it's coming out when?
Soon as we get distribution, probably early next soon.
Okay, here it is. Dewey, is this a world premiere?
It's a world cable premiere, Mr. King. It's been on a friend of mine's podcast.
For the first time on cable, Dewey Gordon, and He Was the King. Let's all listen and enjoy.
I never met Michael, but I wish that I did. He made me feel like an 8-year-old kid. I wanted to curl up in a Neverland bed. Never could get that out of my head. I'd watch him sing and I'd hear him dance, and I'd ask myself, could I fit in his pants? When I left my group and went out on my own, could I be like Michael, grown up but not grown? He was the king, he was the world, he was a boy, he was a girl, he walked the moon, he hung with the stars, on Earth or on Mars. Wherever he'd sing, he was the king. He was the king. The world, he was a boy, he was a girl, he walked the
the king. He was the king. He was the king.
Just let me know. Dewey Gordon and his new song about Michael Jackson. Dewey, have you had any reaction from the Jackson family to this song yet?
Yes, sir, Mr. King. Tito said he was definitely going to send it to Marlon.
Now, that's good news. Mm-hmm. And for you, what's next?
Oh, I'm going out in July for 6 weeks in a fabulous production that combines the music of Grease and the music of Hair in one show on a number of cruise ships. It's a great evening, and you're back in your stateroom by 9.
The great Dewey Gordon joining us here on the outskirts of Neverland. Tomorrow night we hope to be back inside the grounds with a special panel on Sarah Palin. From Almost Neverland, good night.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. Yes, even when we're looking back, we have to look a little less back. Tiger Woods, did you hear about this? Tiger Woods announced Friday he's taking an indefinite break from golf. Quote, I'm deeply aware of the disappointment hurt by infidelity has caused to so many people, most of all my wife and children. I want to say again to everyone that I am profoundly sorry and that I ask forgiveness. It may not be possible to repair the damage I've done, but I want to do my best to try. He asked for a safe haven for personal healing. The daytime talk show The View apologized for calling one of Tiger Woods' alleged girlfriends a hooker. In a statement, the show said Joy Behar's remark about Rachel Yucatel was a joke. But the show apologized for any hurt feelings or misimpressions. Yucatel's lawyer, Gloria Allred, had demanded the apology. Said her client was highly offended. And one of Tiger Woods' alleged mistresses is apologizing to the golfer's wife, Jamie Grubbs, whose phone mail message from Woods was made public last week, went on the television show Extra. Hey, there's some good tube time for Jamie to talk about her affair with Woods. She expressed regret for any pain she may have caused Woods' wife. I have no words to explain what I've done to her and her family. I guess I would be deeply sorry for never considering her during the whole process, and him not bringing her up was just a way for me to just pretend he did not have one and for me not to deal with it. I'm not going to ever say what I did was okay. But there are non-Tiger Woods apologies also this week, ladies and gentlemen. Fear not. The British commercial television network ITV has issued an apology after a rat was allegedly killed and cooked during an episode of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. The network said it will tighten its procedures. Yes, people on that show should only be eating raw rats. I can tell that. Charges are being brought against series winner Gina DeCampo and fellow contestant Stuart Manning after the rat was apparently butchered to add to a meal. ITV said it was an oversight that the production team did not check whether the killing of a rat was lawful. They ate the rat. Dateline Detroit convicted ex-Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick has apologized for his behavior in court, where a judge is reviewing his compliance with orders to make about $1 million in restitution to the city. I said restitution. Kilpatrick stopped on the steps outside Wayne County Circuit Court and publicly apologized to Detroit and his new employer. After leaving jail on an obstruction of justice sentence, he started work in Texas for Covisint, whatever that is. Monday of this week, prosecutors got Kilpatrick to admit his failure to report thousands of dollars in assets. Kilpatrick says he isn't that guy who appeared in court the previous day. He also says he wants to finish paying the restitution as much as anybody else. Nah. And a top aide, friend, and advisor to Kilpatrick, Condia Milton, apologized to his family and the residents of Detroit in federal court this week as he pleaded guilty to a bribery conspiracy charge. Makes New Orleans look sort of nice. Deadline Dublin. The Irish bishops have apologized as a group for clerical abuse of children. They had clerks do that? Oh, I see. And agreed to work with the government to set up a mechanism to ensure that abuse allegations are properly handled. Bishops suspended normal business at their winter general meeting in Maynooth to consider the findings of that special commission handling clerical abuse charges. Maynooth. Who knew? Deadline Taipei, Taiwan. Premier Wu Denyi apologized this week for calling Taiwan independent supporters idiots. and descendants of a British missionary and the descendants of cannibals who killed and ate him 170 years ago got together this week to bury the hatchet. The South Pacific island of Arrumango is now predominantly Christian, been feeling bad about the murder of prominent missionary John Williamson, invited his great-great-grandson and a handful of other relatives to accept their apology. Sorry, we ate your granddad, great-great-great-granddad. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Oh, and the Tennessee mayor who said that Barack Obama scheduled his West Point speech to prevent the Peanuts Christmas special from being aired on his Facebook page, he said that. He has now apologized, said it was all a joke, and has deleted his Facebook account. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via WBCQ, the planet. 7.41 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet on your computer at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, whenever you want it. On your smartphone via Stitcher.com, available as a free download for members at audible.com/show, and is available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And be just like you coming to see the Xmas Hanukkah show in New York or New Orleans, if you'd agree to join me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much, uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of music heard here on, just part of the panorama of stuff at harryshearer.com. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. I'll see you on Twitter, at LeTwits. I won't actually see you. I can't see you now, either. I can't see anything. Uh-oh. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.